Well, hello, hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon. And today's podcast, you really need to listen to. We are interviewing the legal brains at Berta Dotto, and they're going to teach us all about the things we're doing wrong, the legalities of compounding IV therapies, peptides, moving them across state lines. I'm so excited. I can't wait. Let's meet our superstar lawyers. Go ahead, guys. Introduce yourselves.
So my name is Michael Bird. I'm a partner at Berta Dotto, and we are business attorneys for healthcare practices. And my better half, oh, did I say that out loud?
Yes, you did.
Mr. Brad over here.
Yes, I'm the Adotto of the Berta Dotto, and also, I guess, a partner here. And we're super excited to be on your show today.
Amazing. Where are you guys located?
Well, we're actually the mothership's in Dallas, but we also have an office in Chicago and a satellite in North Carolina.
My goodness, are you guys okay with the hurricane? That's so crazy.
Yeah, no problem here.
But Houston got it. Yeah.
Our brethren down in Houston that we have friends and family down there, a lot of electricity loss, but so far no massive damage.
Oh my goodness. Well, that's good. Well, I have met Brad in person at many meetings, and Michael, we've done a podcast before, and I think that you guys have so much knowledge. If you guys that are listening, if you're injectors, if you run a med spa or an aesthetic clinic, honestly, you really need to reach out to Berta Dotto because they are so helpful in understanding the laws of your state and what people can and can't do, you know, with practice guidelines, with all the different levels of providers that we have. And also just understanding the legalities as they happen. So I wanted to dive right in because every meeting I go to, I'm seeing compounding companies setting up, saying they can ship me products across state lines. I'm super interested in biohacking and using peptides, IV therapies, all these things. Can you dive into that problem and explain what you're seeing going on as a trend right now?
Yeah, sure. And I think, you know, for the audience, maybe to take a step back before we kind of jump into that, make sure they understand, you know, this area of law is really unique because it really dives into three different areas. You have both medical board rules, you have nursing board rules, and you have pharmaceutical rules. So that's the first thing that you have to understand. And more importantly, you have the FDA. So you have the federal government involved at some level, right? Which this has to do with when you have peptides or semaglutides, there are certain things that are FDA approved that when you're prescribing something, you're prescribing it on label, basically that, oh, this has been approved for this particular piece. Most of the peptides that are out there are being off-label utilized, meaning that it hasn't been approved by the FDA. And so because of that, one issue is as you as the prescriber. So if you're the physician or PA or nurse practitioner, you need to make sure that your patient consents and they understand that they're using an off-label product, meaning it's not something that the FDA has directly approved. That doesn't mean that you're prescribing something that's harmful. It just that's the first piece. So the question, though, which is I want to make sure we kind of establish a little bit of a footprint is, a lot of practices are either on the border or they're treating people across borders. And we can jump into the telemedicine rules later on that piece. But let's just pretend to your example that a patient is in a separate state and you have prescribed something to them. How do I then get that product to them? Can I drop ship it from my office directly to their office? Utilize a third party to do that. So that goes back to your statement about all these compounding companies. Generally speaking, when we advise people in this space, the easiest answer is, the more you can have that third-party pharmacy ship it directly to the patient. So getting to where your question really was one of the issues that people don't realize is because you have to deal with pharmaceutical rules, it's safest for most states and most of our clients. We advise them to have the outside pharmacy or a compound pharmacy directly ship it to the patient to not have to worry about meeting all these pharmaceutical rules. But I know Michael wanted to jump in and I can always come back to that.
Yeah. So this becomes important because each state's different on what they will allow a medical practice to do. So in some states like Texas, there are strict rules about a medical practice dispensing of medication. And so you bring in a lot of blockers if you try to have the product go out of your office yourself. And then in other states, you bring in the pharmacy rules no matter what, and you have to make sure that you are compliant with that added layer of rules, as Brad was just talking about. And so clients that want to have more certainty from a risk perspective goes to what Brad's just suggested, where they do things in the more traditional manner of writing a prescription and having that fulfilled by a third party.
Yeah. And what Michael's alluding to, Dr. K, is dispensing laws. The dispensing laws are really different every single state. And where people get confused is they say, well, when the patient came in for the very first time, I showed them how to inject properly and gave them the videos. Why can't the next time they want to order some more of the product, can I just have them come in and do it each time? And the answer is, in most states, if you have medicine on site and the stuff that they bought, and you are then injecting them with them, training them up how to utilize it, especially with, you know, we're talking about with the peptides, and you send them home with it, once they leave with that product, there's a couple things. Number one, you should never let them bring it back on site with you because you don't know how they're storing it. You don't know if they were using clean or dirty needles. You just don't know what's going to happen. So we always say once they leave with it, that's it. And then thereafter, unless you have a dispensing license, you can't then have it shipped to your office and then mail it to the patient. And again, because those rules are so different in every state, and we do have some clients that, you know, they're in a state that's easier. It's just like, $500 fee that you pay to get the dispense. But the vast majority of states are not that easy. And the vast majority of states require you to have a pharmacist who they can oversee how you're handling the dispensing.
Well, that's a very good point. There's so many clinics out there dispensing semaglutide that's compounded, that's not truly Ozempic, Wegovy, or the Mounjaro, the brand name stuff. So yeah, this applies right to all of those people. And for patients right out there, what are the big concerns that you're seeing? We certainly have all heard about side effects of, you know, compounded products.
Well, I think for patients, this is such a hot market, and this is becoming closer and closer to a direct consumer option. And so patients don't realize that this is, you know, medical care, prescriptive grade. And so not going through a traditional channel to have a physician that knows the standard of care, or a nurse practitioner or PA that knows the standard of care, that can safely prescribe and put you on a plan, is really what raises the risk the most. I heard an anecdotal story, Dr. K, of a plastic surgeon who just happened to work out with someone who was thinking about getting on a semaglutide. And the doctor said, well, a few weeks and we'll get you set up. And he didn't see him. And so like 6 weeks passed and the doctor saw him again and asked him that question. And I said, oh, did you decide not to go forward? And he said, oh, no, I just went home that night and Googled it and got it directly shipped to my house.
Gotcha.
And so there's already a non-compliant market that's out there. And so to your question, the patients out there, that's where the most risk lies.
Yeah. And the secondary risk to that is not only realizing, as Michael said, this is a medical treatment, and having someone that understands your body and your pros and cons of utilizing this and how much you should be utilizing it. That's why it's so important to work with those medical providers. But a lot of times patients are like, oh, wow, it says if I dose myself with, you know, this amount, well, I want to lose a little more weight this week, so I'm going to increase it a little bit, or I'm going to do more than a shot a day, or whatever that has been recommended by the provider, or, you know, if you're ordering it offline, whatever's on that piece of paper, right? And that's why there's been a huge uptick in people poisoning themselves, because they're giving themselves more than required because they think that will help them lose weight faster. And that's not always the case.
If that's not how it works, Brad, a little bit is good, so more must be better.
I mean, it depends.
That's what they taught me in college.
Yes, exactly. When it comes to beer drinking and other things, maybe. Yeah. Especially red wine. We know we have to have that next time.
The red wine, yes. We need our wine education.
Michael's
going to educate us on that. But I think conversely, like, there are good providers out there that are using compounded versions of semaglutide and getting good results for their patients. So, you know, we've seen the opposite being true also, that you can get a prescription product very safely, very legally. You can also legally use compounded products in a non-FDA approved way.
Absolutely. And that's a great point, is that there's nothing wrong with using compounding products in the sense that it doesn't mean that you can't get good or bad results. What you really have to understand is, how does your medical board or nursing board view the utilization of compounding? So I can give you two examples. One is the state of Mississippi. So the state of Mississippi has said utilizing compounding for weight loss, they had decided that it's not within the standard of care. So they're the first state to come out and actually tell their physicians that you can't use it and that they don't believe in using other drugs that are FDA approved for off labels. So they've actually basically said, unless you're getting the brand drug that has been FDA approved, we believe that you're not consistent with standard of care. So they're the only state I'm aware of at this very moment. We just had an investigation in Texas that we just closed. And the physician, who was a plastic surgeon, was brought up in front of the medical board because he was using an off-label pharmacy. And based on the medical record and the explanation, they had no problem with the fact that he was using an off-label. And the physician had followed all the protocols of following the standard of care, had the proper patient consents, everything that was required. And the medical board had no finding against this particular physician because they're like, no, this is exactly what we want our doctors to be using. And if you are using off-label, that you're doing it correctly. So that was the good news, was this was the first one we had seen, at least come across our desk, and that because the physician had done everything properly, they just dismissed it.
Can you talk a little bit about California? California has a very tricky legal landscape with regards to this. What are some pearls about California practice?
Well, as you know, California does not like employers and they don't like physicians. But besides that, things are great there. Beautiful territory there. But what I would say is California has some really interesting rules or restrictive rules when it comes to utilization. They are really making it harder and harder for pharmacies in California to actually buy the products they need to then use to compound the drugs. And so that's been one of the big shortages that's been happening in California, even though other states are doing it, meaning that there's certain ingredients that you need to develop these peptides, and California's made it harder to ship these ingredients in from other states. They actually made it more difficult. And I'm not exactly sure. I mean, we've spoken with many different attorneys in California on this particular issue. No one can really put their thumb as to why they're making it more difficult, except that it is California, which has meant that a lot of clients in California are trying to figure out, well, what if I ship all the product to my Nevada office and then just load it up in a U-Haul and then drive it, you know, over to my office, and then I can dispense it from there. It's the Smokey and the Abandoned kind of reference, if anyone can understand that joke. But the concept is, if you're doing that, you're actually violating both states' laws, meaning that when you have something shipped to your office, it's before that particular office. You can't, again, dispense it elsewhere. And California, unless you have a dispensing license there, you can't drive it to another state. So you're having to deal with two different states' pharmaceutical rules. And it's not that I haven't heard people are doing that, or the rumors are that other people are doing it that way. But I'm just saying that if you are doing that, you have exposure to the pharmaceutical rules. And then, of course, if you violate those rules, that you have exposure to the medical board rules. And I'll let you jump in. I know you have a story on that too.
No, yeah. I mean, we have a lot of clients in California who are successfully able to implement this. And so kind of going back to the recipe for how can you do it? Number one is setting up the right processes from a clinical perspective, having the good faith exam, just like you would for another medical treatment, and having a treatment plan in place for the patients, and then navigating to the pharmacy rules that Brad just mentioned, understanding that there's a bunch of different variables depending on the way you're trying to accomplish it, which kind of brings us full circle back to, if you can find a supplier, a third party pharmacy that will fulfill the prescription directly, that's going to be a path of least resistance. But there can be some other ways. It's just, I think thematically, one of the trickiest supply issues in California that Brad was alluding to is that California has really strict certifications or rules on being recognized as a pharmacy. And so if you're out of state and you are not recognized by their pharmacy board, there's blocks that get in place there. And so getting the supply has been one of the bigger challenges that we've had our California clients face.
I know, Dr. K, of many individuals who are not in the state of California who are trying to find ways to build pharmacies that can then ship into California, meaning that build a successful pharmacy that can then dispense into California, because it's easier for them to set up shop and get a dispensing license. Nothing's easy in California, but their theory is that if I build a pharmacy out of state in a state where I can then get a dispensing license in California, that actually might be an easier way to actually make sure that I can be that resource for those clinics in California. So it's just been fascinating to see this accelerant. And Michael's been practicing about 800 years. I'm a little over 25 years, but I've never seen, I mean, just 2 years ago, I guess, plus now, I remember having some conversations with plastic surgeons on this new wonder drug, and then Ozempic. And then within weeks, my phone started blowing up about all these other people trying to get into it. And over this last 12 to 15 months now, the number of phone calls we get from entrepreneurs trying to jump in the space is extremely high.
Yeah, there's definitely companies out there teaching physicians and providers how to bring it into their practices. But I guess, Michael, if you had to outline a path of due diligence for us to do, like, I definitely want to do some glutides in my office. I definitely want to do IVs and peptides. So first, I need to check with my medical board. And then secondly, like a pharmacy dispensing license, I got to check with the dispensary board. What are the official steps we should
do? Checklist. Yeah. So, and I'll say this because I want to expand your question for the sake of the audience, because there's a movement, this wellness / anti-aging / weight loss movement that's kind of blending into aesthetics. It's all, you know, you could brand yourself as a wellness center and you're going to have some aesthetic services or vice versa. Mm-hmm. And the anti-aging, wellness, weight loss side all have the issues that we're talking about for semaglutide. They tend to have the off-label type issues or risks from a standard of care perspective that are more kind of bleeding edge type treatments. And so your risk as a practitioner is a little more risky. You don't have as much science to back your decision to treat with those types of treatments. And so you have to recognize that. But from the checklist, going back to your checklist perspective, Dr. K, I think just understanding that adding these treatments is the same as adding any other treatments in your office. So it requires the same process as far as the, you know, good faith exam of the patients, having a treatment plan, making sure the right people with the right licenses are administering to the extent there is going to be administering happening. And then the secondary piece is gaining clarity on, if it's a semaglutide, you know, what path you want to go to service this. So mm-hmm. the patient's going to come in, they're going to get clear, they're going to be instructed how to use it. And then, you know, they get the prescription, they fill it on their own, it's drop shipped from a compounding pharmacy to their house, they self-inject, and then they have these regularly scheduled check-ins where they come back in to the office to weigh in, et cetera. That's going to be pretty straightforward if you go that route. It's when there's the temptation to dispense, administer inside the office that there's not an easy check the box there. That's a conversation with a healthcare attorney to get details of what that process would look like and make sure that it's going to be doable.
Yeah. And I'll add two things to what Michael said. Number one is most of our clients who have looked in trying to figure they could dispense because they want to capture the sale of the product realize it's too cumbersome for them. So a lot of them don't do that part. Second piece is Michael said a couple times, and I have too, for our audience members who, in your case, that they don't know what the good faith exam is, that's a reference to, that's the time in which that physician or nurse practitioner, PA, are terming, you know, is the person a good candidate for that service? And that includes, you know, that weight loss drug. And that's an important element. And the follow-up question that I always get with a live audience is, well, can I use telemedicine to utilize that? And the answer is generally yes in almost every single state, so long as you're following whatever the standard of care is required for your particular state. So that's the piece I wanted to add. And then you asked a question earlier that made me think of something. When people are deciding to go that route and they are adding it as a one of the things to worry about on your checklist that you were mentioning is how you market it. A lot of people have unfortunately fallen into that, oh, you know, we have Ozempic here or we have whatever. And they're using the name brand. They're actually using the logo of that. And what they don't realize is that when you're utilizing someone else's brand name, their goodwill they built up with it, and you're not prescribing that, there's two major issues. One is you have the actual brand owner who's getting upset that you're telling everyone that you're going to use their brand and you're really not. So there's been a bunch of lawsuits now out there on that particular issue because you're using their trademark and all the goodwill they built into it and on your website to build up your brand. So that's the first thing. And number two, if you're using compounding, you're not utilizing their brand. So you can't say I'm using Ozempic because you're not. You can describe what it is, a weight loss drug and stuff, but we'd say stay away from the brand names unless you are utilizing that particular brand name. And last but certainly not least, the Federal Trade Commission and your medical boards have deals with medical advertising. So if you're doing that, it could be considered false, deceptive, misleading if you're telling everyone you're using Ozempic or using Wegovy and you're really doing compounding. So be very careful. It sounds fun from a marketing perspective, and I get that. But again, from a legal perspective, you're opening yourself to unnecessary risk.
Very true. Now, should I be asking my pharmacy if they are a 503B pharmacy? And exactly what is this 503B business?
It's just a category that has to do with compounding. That's the harder question because, I mean, again, depending on how your state is listed, some states do have it listed on their website as to who meets that criteria, others don't. I think it's a fair question to make sure that, you know, at the very minimum, that if you are going to be using a particular pharmacy, how much legwork have they really truly put in? Obviously, you want to make sure that they have a good reputation, a sterile environment, all the things that you need so that when you are prescribing it from that perspective.
So that's like an outsourcing facility that might make your compounded drugs and they follow these good manufacturing practices. They've been by the FDA. They're manufactured under supervision of a licensed pharmacist.
Right. And to Michael's point earlier, that there are some, as more money gets thrown into a particular line of business, there are more bad actors that want to jump in there. And all that is doing is establishing the fact that they meet at least the minimum rules required to be a sterile environment to compound the product that they're pushing out.
But perhaps we should look for that, the 503B steps. They meet that minimum requirement. And then I think that it's so interesting that aesthetics meetings these days, we're seeing products pop up on the exhibit hall floor. This past month or two, I went to Vegas Cosmetic Surgery and the Aesthetic Show, and there are all kinds of products on the floor that are brand new, like salmon sperm generated polynucleotides and peptides and pDRNA and products that are platelet derived growth factor also. All these really interesting new technologies, but they're only licensed for use for like topical use with microneedling, I think. And in so doing, they've bypassed a lot of FDA clinical trial testing. But it almost feels like these companies already know that people are going to be blending these and injecting them in a manner that they were not designed to be used for. Can you talk a little bit about that and what risks do we expose ourselves to when we are using these products in that off-label manner? It's not even a label question because they're labeled as cosmeceutical topical creams.
So the easiest answer I can give on that is let's go jump back to aspirin, right? Bare aspirin. When it first came out, it was utilized to help with, you know, headaches, right? And physicians started learning that people who were taking aspirin, it was helping with their blood flow also. And so doctors started saying, hey, to help with your blood flow, I want you to start taking, you know, 4 aspirin a day. It has nothing to do with headaches, right? But they realized as within the standard of care, as an off-label use of aspirin, it was a way to help improve a patient's health. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to some of these product lines, they may be testing it for, you know, item A. And I know you can give another example of something that everyone's very familiar with. And so they might say, oh, yes, you can utilize it for this. Now, if they then turn you and say, oh, and by the way, Dr. K, you can use it for A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, even though it's off-label, and we think it's fine. Number one, they can get in massive trouble with the FDA. They're not allowed to go out there and market it themselves that way, because if they are doing that and it has not been FDA approved for that, and there's a wink and a nod, we've seen over the years, big manufacturers get popped pretty hard for that. But again, going back to the physician then gets to choose, do I want to use this product for how it was, the benefit of what they said the FDA has done? Or do I believe, consistent with the standard of care, there are ways I can use this as an off-label utilization? So there are ways to look at it, but I would say be very mindful. Again, every state really looks at these things differently. The more out there and more aggressive you are as a provider outside the scope of what other people are doing, and there's not much data out there, the more likelihood that other people might start looking at you going, wow, this person's really out there. They're using a procedure or they're using a product that no one else is utilizing. And there's no scientific proof that what they're doing is going to be helpful to the patient. So be mindful that, unfortunately, in the practice of medicine, if you are going to be a risk taker, do it through a research program. Do it with, you know, a lot of different processes that you put in place to protect yourself. And more importantly, the patients realizing that they're a part of something bigger and different.
And you would say, and I know you're thinking I was going to talk about Botox, but it's most Botox uses is still off label, but they're on these out there kind of new age treatments. I think of stem cell as something that is a great analogy, mm-hmm. and you have to worry about medical board. And I don't know, Brad, if you wanted to add to.
Yeah. I mean, stem cells is a super hot topic still with medical boards. We've been in this space for over a decade now and watching how medical boards respond to the utilization of stem cells. And the issue is many state medical boards think that the utilization of stem cells is not consistent with the standard of care unless you're part of a research project. Again, I know of a lot of pop-up stem cell places that are owned and operated by entrepreneurs, and sometimes doctors are involved. But generally speaking, you'd be very careful about how a state would view that. And so to the point where Michael is saying is, like, we looked at this for Texas many different times, and you have to be very careful how you use stem cells in the state of Texas and other states, like I think New York's that way, same, and maybe in California.
Most likely, yes. So stem cells and exosomes. Exosomes is a hot topic lately. And you might see that they're at every booth, they're talking about using it after microneedling. So it just soaks into the skin without being injected. But then I see people blatantly advertising IV exosome therapy or exosomes injected into the scalp or into the face. So I guess we, of course, off-label, we can use these techniques and technologies, but you subject yourself to a lot of risk. Like if something goes wrong with that one patient and they turn around and say, you didn't tell me that this right. is not really designed for this purpose, then what?
Yeah. And you got to be careful what you claim it will do, correct. Even if you get clear from a standard of care perspective.
Yeah, there's an IV bar right before COVID that got popped pretty hard by the FTC. Because they were claiming that by utilizing their IV bar and product line, that it would have all these huge benefits, and none of it was true. And I guess the FTC had warned them and they didn't do anything about it because they hit them with a massive fine. And they said, every single time you have this out there, we're going to hit you with another fine on top of that. So this particular IV bar had to shut down its website and start pulling down all the advertisement papers and magazines because they've been falsely advertising outcomes that were not scientifically proven.
Interesting. Well, I'm sure that's going to start happening in LA because literally I see IV stem cells and IV exosomes on the menus of very big commercial entities. And then you also just wonder, like, do they even have a physician on site? Like, is there any sterility involved? And where the hell are they getting these stem cells from? Like, you mm-hmm. know, whose stem cells are they using? It's not harvested from the patient.
Yeah,
so I feel like there's so many, it's going to be fraught with so much difficulty. So I worry for the aesthetic community because people are, like you said, trying to be on the bleeding cutting edge, but it's like jump first and look later.
Yeah.
Fair.
Or shoot first and then aim.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That sounds like a Texas thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Sounds like a Texas thing. There was, wasn't there a death with an IV hydration bar recently? And then a lot of scrutiny has come upon the whole IV.
About a year ago. Yeah. Yeah. About a year ago, you know, it had all the things that you're not supposed to do involved. So you had a remote IV bar run by an esthetician who had no formal training. The doctor was an hour and a half away, had only been physically to the location once at the grand opening, no written protocols, no good faith exam. Mm-hmm. And the practitioner had heard that if you add something to the IV, it's going to do something great, and had no idea on the efficacy of doing so. And the patient died.
Yeah. And the physician did a lot of things wrong in that one. One of which was left prescriptive drugs there with no real explanation of when and how to utilize it. And so when the non-physician decided to inject this into the IV bag, it ended up causing the individual to have a heart attack and basically die on the table. because this person had a heart condition, which was actually had been disclosed in the patient consent, but this person didn't know by giving this injection. And when I've spoken to other physicians about this, they're like, yeah, every single physician would know that they could not have given this person drug. But of course, the physician was never involved, and this person had no formal training. And there's good news, bad news. The good news is that it brings light to the need to do things correctly. The bad news is a lot of state actors here in Texas are like, we need to go shut down all the IV bars. Like, we need, you know, so they overreact. And so there could be very compliant IV bars, and they might be, you know, on the state list, or they may say only doctors now can own IV bars, or only doctors can provide IVs, which of course would be impossible. You need your RNs and other individuals to help do IVs. And so that's the reaction that we typically see, is the state overreacts to try to protect its citizens, which is good. But most of the time, you know, nothing against state legislators, but they have no understanding of the practice of medicine. So they come up with these wild ideas that are not practical.
I mean, maybe they should start with estheticians should probably not be doing any of this, like stick with the spirit. But I think Texas is very, very liberal. Colorado, a couple of these states where you can just be a beauty school graduate and start doing injectables on patients.
Yeah. The concept is in states like Texas or Virginia, I think, is it Pennsylvania this way too, if I remember correctly, but it basically goes back to the idea as a physician, you have the proper training and knowledge to know if you are going to delegate to someone that you believe they have the ability and skill set to do it. So that if you do say, hey, esthetician, you can go do this injection, or you can fire this laser or do the IV, it's because you, the physician, believe they can do that. Now, one of the things that most attorneys may say, which I know that you would say too, is that just because you can doesn't mean you should. And so the fact that someone doesn't have that formal training, do you want to go stand in front of the medical board now and say, yes, I told this person to fire a laser who has no anatomy training, or I told someone to inject near the eye that has no formal anatomy training, and I felt comfortable doing that. So it's your license you're putting up there. That's the scary part.
And the story that we were just talking about, that doctor's license was suspended because he delegated to an esthetician. So it's really the doctor is supersizing their own personal risk in a state like Texas when they allow, you know, someone without that formal training to provide treatments.
Yeah.
And they often don't realize it.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's rampant in our industry that a medical director will supervise 10 or 20 med spas, and they're very much offsite. Perhaps they're not even in aesthetics, like they might be a urologist or OB-GYN or emergency room doctor. I mean, what are your thoughts on that and the dangers that that presents?
Well,
it's very common.
It's common. And I think the way I would answer this, Dr. K, is, and it's context for everything that we see out there, is if you have a physician who's engaged and has received enough training to know how to do the treatments that are being provided in a safe manner, that you generally are going to have a compliant setup. Now, will it be as good as someone who's board certified? No, of course not. But with the spectrum of things that we see out there, you know, our compliance kind of line in the sand that we've drawn from a risk perspective is, do you have an absentee physician or an engaged physician? If you have an engaged physician, you're going to be much less at risk from a compliance perspective.
Yeah. And that's going back to boards investigations. Generally speaking, you know, most boards care about the patient care. And that doesn't mean that if you have a very active physician, that doesn't mean bad things don't happen, right? It does. Unfortunately, things happen where just that patient had a bad reaction to something that I have so many different stories of that over my lifetime, where great doctor doing a great thing and that has done this injection 1,000 times. And for some reason that person had a really negative reaction to it. The concept is then when bad things happen, what do you have in place to protect yourself? And that was the whole, there's no protocols, there's no training, there's no process in place as to what to do. And that's a protection for you, the physician, your staff, and obviously the patient, because that means that they know how to handle when something bad happens and how to respond to that. And those physicians, and we're aware of many, like you said, who are medical directors for 15, 20 locations. Well, if they have multiple sub doctors underneath them who are then there looking it over, great. Or they go every week to a different location and they're constantly rotating. Great. Like, there are ways to do these things legally and to have that same kind of protection built in. But the more you remove yourself as a supervising physician from a location or oversight, the more likelihood mistakes are being made and that you don't know. And then you're subjecting your license for $1,500, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 a month, only to find out that now you get suspended and or in that your case, the case in Texas, make national news. And that's not what you're going to make national news for.
Yeah, I think patients are not aware of this whole process when they come into a med spa and they see a provider, nurse practitioner, PA, whoever they're seeing. I don't think they realize that sometimes people don't necessarily have a ton of training and they're being backed by someone who's offsite. So I would say for patients who are listening, that's super important to consider and ask about, and like, who is your medical director? How does he supervise you here? Am I going to get to meet him? How do you guys feel about those FaceTime iPad consults for good faith exams? Is that a good acceptable use of telemedicine?
Generally speaking, yeah. I mean, the question, the risk comes back to, can the doctor do so and meet the standard of care?
Right.
And so it is treatment specific. And again, the risk is back on the medical license.
Yeah. And so the utilization of that room, obviously meeting all the, you know, privacy standards that you would have to meet by utilizing that technology, great. But to Michael's point, if there is a treatment, so I have a client of ours that does a lot of laser treatments. And we were talking about the utilization of telemedicine and facing, you know, looking at the person and talking to them. And what would you need to do to be in that room to determine if they're a good candidate? Same concept, right? If you're standing in the room, what are the things you need to do? And they said, oh, this one laser treatment, I like to touch the skin to see how it responds. Okay, great. Well, you can't do that via telemedicine then. If you think within the standard of care that you have to touch the skin before you fire a laser or before you prescribe the treatment, then you can't do that, right? Because if that's you touching it and responding. But if everything else is, no, I'm just looking at the curvature, or if I'm looking at their pigmentation or whatever else they need to make a determination, great. And so long as you're using the right equipment, we don't recommend, generally speaking, especially for aesthetics, phone. We do recommend video, and iPads are great because, you know, it's high definition, proper lighting, everything else that you would need to make sure that you, the physician or the provider, have enough information to then say, yes, I think, Brad, you are a good candidate for A, B, C, or D.
Okay, perfect. And then I want to change tracks to one other new subject. So artificial intelligence in the office. We're definitely having a ton of employees start using ChatGPT and creation of, you know, products that we use for marketing, blog posts, things on our website. We're using some AI in the office for patient care too. Do you guys have any guidelines for use of AI in the office setting for your employees? I kind of feel like I need them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that patient privacy is going to be the biggest issue in a medical practice. So there's ChatGPT where you're putting your stuff out into the world, or there might be something that's self-contained within the office that may not meet it. But the biggest issue, there's so many different uses for it, is data security. And, you know, in a medical practice, is there going to be some risks where HIPAA is going to be brought in, or a state level, you know, privacy law?
Yeah. And the other piece that we've had conversations with people about, building out protocols about how to clear a patient for something that if the patient answers A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, and the AI then determines what course or treatment that patient should receive. If you're a provider and you're utilizing that as a sole means to clear a patient, you absolutely have exposure, because, you know, there are software components that already exist that kind of give you ideas about maybe a recommendation, but ultimately you, the physician, you, the nurse practitioner, PA, depending on your state, have to make that determination. You can't skip that step and allow that RN or whoever the other person is to then say, oh, well, if the AI says they're a good candidate, they're a good candidate. So that's one of the fears I see, or the utilization of people who are trying to say, oh, this is great because now I don't have to do the good faith exam. AI is doing it based on plug and play information that the patient gives us that we then utilize. So that's AI being utilized from Michael's perspective. And then lastly, on AI, this again goes back to the advertisement rules, is that if you start putting in photos and AI starts cleaning them up or enhancing them, again, be mindful of before and after pictures, or creating before and after pictures that don't exist. That is false, deceptive, and misleading. And in most states, you can get in trouble with your boards, much less the FTC.
Very, very true. I was also thinking of just like you know, plagiarism and making sure ChatGPT liberally borrows from everywhere. And then if we use information on our website, we don't want to be sued later for using someone else's work or words.
Absolutely.
And then one last question before we wrap it up about peptides. So we've heard of, you know, the bodybuilders buying BPC-157 online, using veterinary products to inject. This next generation of biohacking is going to bring these interesting new molecules out there. What, have you seen any interesting cases or difficulties with the use of those?
Yes. And the big issue that we have seen when we've looked at this, because we've had this has come across our desk, is that these products are not FDA approved at all for humans. Many times, especially the BPC-157 and what GHK-U. Yeah, so there's a bunch of ones out there that we're seeing that people are like, oh, this is great because A, B, C, and D, but you have to be obscenely careful if you're using a product that's been approved for horses or other animals, and then you're prescribing for humans. The informed consent for that would boggle my mind as to all the things you would have to say, because it's never been even approved for humans. And in some states, that you have to be part of a research project. You can't just describe it, which again, you know, depending on the state and their rules for off-label, because this is way outside even the typical off-label utilization. So I would be very hesitant to utilize those in a typical practice until it's further been tested on humans. You don't want your patients to be the guinea pigs here, literally.
Yeah, the biohacking community is well into it, but well, let's see what happens to that test generation of humans. But I do think it's amazing that you guys stay so cutting edge. Like, as this industry evolves, you have no choice but to also evolve and see the case law starting to form. And it's each case, it's very challenging what we're doing here.
It's fun though.
Yeah, it is. Any last minute words of advice for injectors out there, people that are trying to enter this industry and stay safe?
I feel like I just have to step back for a moment for our audience and just acknowledge that a lot of the stuff we talked about are really great things and there are some great benefits. And so it can be confusing listening to lawyers talk about these services for, you know, 45 minutes to an hour, because we're focused on it from a compliance and risk perspective.
That's right.
And I don't want to lose sight of the fact that there's some wonderful things out there that are really helping people.
Completely agree. Well said, sir.
That's so true. Same here. We're doing Ozempic and prescriptions for weight loss in the office. Here in my own office, we decided to use only the FDA-approved medications with prescriptions. It's easiest. But I am looking at using compounded stuff for IV use as well as for peptides. And we are doing some off-label things with exosomes and other growth factors. So it's super exciting, but I want to make sure that we vet the industries, look at the clinical trials that have been done and have some research basis for what we're doing, because otherwise it's just the wild, wild west out here.
Yes.
All right. Well, that's it for now, guys. Where can people find you, Bertadotto?
Website is bertadotto.com. And do you know our social media handle?
Our social media handle is Bertadotto.
I knew it.
Law.
Okay, good job. Bertadotto Law. That's B-Y-R-D. Adotto is A-D-A-T-T-O.
Yes,
and
yes.
There you go. There you have it. And next year, for sure, they're going to be at some of the Vegas conferences. I encourage all of you guys to reach out and ask your really difficult, tricky questions. They're such a great resource. Thank you, Michael. And thank you, Brad.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, of course. And don't forget to find me on my Instagram. It's Beauty by Dr. K, doing amazing things with people's faces and biohacking, bioregenerative therapy. It's all there. You can find me on my Instagram and website, beautybydrk.com. And that's it for now, guys. Stay beautiful and compliant.